This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
It seems to me, when I look at what they've done, that they've basically said what might actually help increase America's equity, capital, research capacity, humanity, empathy, Head Start, Social Security, all the stuff that actually makes America great and compassionate, and said, how can we get rid of that?
This week on Sea Change Radio, the first half of our two-part conversation with author Steve Almond, an astute observer of politics, pop culture, and all things American. In this wide-ranging discussion, we talk about Almond's latest novel, which reveals some of the horrors that immigrants to this country face far too often, look at the painful reality of paying taxes in the age of Trumpism, and examine the seeds of this present-day authoritarianism sown under Ronald Reagan. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Steve Almond. Steve is an author, and his latest novel is All the Secrets of the World. Steve, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Yeah, it's good to be with you, man.
And I should also mention that you have a new nonfiction book called Truth is the Arrow, Mercy is the Bow, a DIY manual for the construction of stories. So when you wrote your 2022 book, you probably couldn't foresee a return to the state that we're in right now with the second Trump administration. How sad are you that you were so prescient in carving out this narrative? Why don't you go back and fill in the blanks for our listeners without spoiling too much of the book, if you can?
Yeah, I mean, I started writing this book, which is really about the dawn of the Reagan Revolution and a young girl, American citizen, but with an undocumented mom and older brother living in Sacramento in 1981. And it was really about kind of the forerunner to Trumpism, which I think was the Reagan Revolution, the idea of kind of the shining mansion on the hill, in which the idea of America is this big, shiny mansion on the hill. And the question that rarely gets asked, almost never, is like, okay, well, who lives in that mansion? And who cleans up that mansion? And who gets arrested if they trespass upon that mansion? And it was a social novel in that sense. It's about the sort of the fate of the individual characters, this family that gets sucked into the criminal justice system. I started writing it back in 2014. And when the 2016 election happened, I got so confused and fatutzled by how I was going to explain to my kids that we'd elected this sadistic, you know, obviously kind of completely driven by shame and projection mess of a human. Like, how would the adults put this guy in charge? And so I wrote a whole book. I toggled away from the novel that I'd been working on and wrote this book, Bad Stories, which was my way of trying to understand Trumpism through the lens of storytelling and literature. Like, I see Trump as basically America's modern Ahab, this guy who's totally driven by wounded masculinity, and he leads the ship of state on this doomed expedition. And I thought we were only going out once with Ahab in search of the white whale that bit off his leg. But it turns out America's really, really, or at least enough Americans and our demented version of democracy are driven enough by grievance and salesmanship and promotion and their own kind of capacity for projection and cruelty to the other and declining sense of cultural utility and all of the ingredients that we needed to re-up it. And so I was definitely shocked by that. But the reason that I ultimately wrote All the Secrets of the World, I returned to it. I started it in 2014 and I returned to it in 2018 and 19. And by then, Alex, we, the U.S. government, and therefore our tax dollars and our support as citizens, were in the business of, you know, ripping apart families, traumatized refugee families coming up, usually fleeing violence and certainly poverty, and certainly believing deeply in the American dream. That's why they friggin' left home and walked through dangerous terrain, sometimes with their kids, to try to hope that the American dream was a real thing. And instead found themselves like little kids and moms being torn apart at the border. And our U.S. government was doing that. So the undocumented characters in that novel, who I knew were going to be an important part of the story I wanted to tell, suddenly it took on a real sense of urgency that my understanding of the story of immigration and how it was being distorted and fear-mongered and demagogued was really what was happening before my eyes. And I felt like I had to write that novel. I had a new sense of urgency. And I think I probably, like a lot of people, underestimated the extent to which our media culture and our political culture and our civic culture would allow to go unchecked the monstrous version of immigration and immigrants that Trump is peddling. You know, the violent ideation that he's constantly putting in people's heads about immigrants who are murdering people and raping people. And, you know, from the beginning was doing this kind of crude eliminationist, dehumanizing, fascist caricaturing of people who are by and large, not all, but by and large, looking for a better life, looking to partake in the American dream. I think part of the reason there's such animus towards immigrants in this country is because they really believe in the American dream. They haven't gotten entitled and addicted and despairing. They really truly believe that the United States is the best place to try to create an opportunity and a better life for themselves and for their children. And I think if you're somebody who's in America and who's feeling despair and a sense of displacement and a sense that your time has passed, and a declining sense of your own worth and utility, you look upon somebody who really believes and who's so hardworking and so full of hope, and you just try to turn them into a monster. You try to just figure out how you can kick them down because you feel so much, to my way of thinking, feel so much despair and shame about your own loss of hope. And so for me, the story of Lorena Sines and her family and what happens when they get sucked into the criminal justice system is just as relevant as can be. We're living it out. One of the characters in the book, without giving away, you know, too much of the plot, is literally deported without her permission, fooled essentially into self-deporting. I mean, again, I'm writing this in 2018. I first started the novel in 2014. I didn't realize that we would, that the second iteration of the Trump regime would be as single-mindedly sadistic and focused on trying to vilify and dehumanize immigrants. That's essentially, rather than protecting the homeland from, for instance, terrorists, domestic and foreign, the Department of Homeland Security is almost entirely dedicated now to the process of, quote unquote, rooting out undocumented workers, who, of course, are called illegal aliens, as if somebody can be an illegal human being, and who have been painted in the popular imagination as this kind of subhuman species of savages, which is just friggin' nonsense for anybody who spent time in immigrant communities. I mean, I lived in El Paso for 4 years, and all I saw was people coming over from Mexico because they wanted a better wage and they wanted a better shake in things. And I think that's as old and beautiful a story of possibility as America offers.
And to build on what you're saying about this sadism, I think that this second iteration, this new brand of sadism, is less single-mindedly focused on just immigration. It seems like this, there's a much wider net being cast in terms of quote-unquote enemies to bring down and to target. This seems like maybe a self-fulfilling prophecy in keeping people from wanting to come to this country. If it becomes not so great, if we dismantle all our government services, if our education system isn't so great, if our economy is collapsed, hey, you don't have an influx of immigrants coming into your country anymore as well.
Well, it's fascinating because I teach at the Nieman Foundation, which is this journalism foundation that's based out of Harvard. And the journalists who come are half of them are American born and half of them are foreign born. And it's always been this incredibly prestigious fellowship for journalists who are a lot more advanced in their careers than I ever was as a journalist. And the idea is they get to come to Harvard for a year, and it's an incredible honor. And of course, anybody who gets selected really feels like, wow, I've made it. And of course, I'm going to embrace this opportunity. Well, you know, I'm talking with the folks who make those decisions, and they're telling me that the most prominent journalists from all over the world are now saying, I don't know if I actually want to come to the United States. I don't know if I will be hassled. I don't know if I'll be able to leave and return if I want to come home. I don't know if I'll be harassed by the government. I don't want to come to the United States. Even look at its media system. It's you know, three quarters of it is propaganda or response to propaganda. And the free press that we think of as like the beacon of America's crowning civic achievement is completely deracinated and hollowed out by capitalism and the profit motive. And, you know, Americans' kind of collective willingness to allow scandal and spectacle to be the central stories that they consume, as opposed to some coherent accounting of how government functions, how it helps you in your life, what Social Security is, the fact that it's an earned benefit, not a friggin' handout, or dot, 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 that our immigration system is not in chaos and there isn't a horde of people pouring off over the border to murder people. That's nonsense. And everybody knows it's nonsense, but there's this paranoid style in American politics that's always been around, but that is kind of reached with the, I think the free press has become so driven by kind of having to scare up viewers and scare up clicks and links, that everything, you know, is oriented around conflict, accusation, violence, you know, just spectacle. And there's almost no good basic civic and explanatory journalism happening. I think the New York Times and NPR and other media organizations are realizing the depth of how important it is to explain to people what Social Security is, what the social safety net is, what the Department of Homeland Security is supposed to do, how government functions, the fact that Congress passes the laws and appropriates the money. And they're literally having to explain to people how government works because we've become so lazy and entitled and blind to it. And the same thing, I hope, is going to be true of how we explain the story of how immigrants function, who they are and why they come here, and the real levels of crime they commit, as opposed to this ridiculous propagandistic version of them as, like, you know, all of them coming over with knives between their teeth, like determined to slaughter white people. It's just like this crazy paranoid fantasy that one side pumps into the bloodstream of America, and we need some kind of vaccine for it.
And now it's winter. Winter in America. And all of the healers done been killed. Sent away. Yeah, the people know it's winter. Winter in America. And ain't nobody fighting cause
nobody... This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to author Steve Almond. So, Steve, I think a lot of us had a moral quandary this tax season, unlike no other. I never thought about filing taxes as a I never questioned it. It was just something you did, right? It's death and taxes. And this was the first time where I filed and I was like, I don't want to be a part of this. Like, I don't want to contribute to what is happening. And whether you like it or not, that's your legal obligation as a, if you're residing for more than 300 days in the U.S., you have to pay your taxes. The reason I know this is because I Googled it. I was like, how long do I have to live overseas to not have to pay taxes? It really made me ponder for the first time, maybe this American experiment isn't for me sometimes.
I understand what you're saying. I think that was true for me long ago. I mean, I think that, for instance, people who are living in other countries, I don't want to idealize, you know, other countries. It's complicated to be a human. It's hard to be a human. Nobody's perfect. Everybody's full of impulses that are good and bad and stories that are good and truthful. And I guess what I'm saying is that my general feeling is that what's afflicting Americans is a kind of loneliness and a lack of empathy and a kind of binary thinking, only being able to think in terms of victims and villains, and an unwillingness to engage with the moral complexity of what it's like to be a citizen of a country, and a kind of lassitude and cynicism, a kind of like, oh, it's all corrupt. It's a kind of laziness. But I think it's more like despair that masks itself as laziness. And when you try to talk with people about their belief system and their values and, you know, why they behave this or that way politically, whether they vote, if they vote for candidates who are against their own interests or who are openly sadistic or propagandistic, it's very difficult because people then become defensive and ashamed and you can't really talk with them. And to me, I'm just naturally more interested in talking with you know, somebody who might be from a Scandinavian country where their relationship to their government is a lot less reflexively dismissive. Oh, they're all cynical. They're all crooks. There's like this creeping cynicism that's so pervasive and it's fed by the internet and it's just demoralizing. And so in a certain way, part of what is what I miss is the feeling of being able to have an honest difference in our values and approach that we can have a rational discussion around. It's all become identity and tribalism and defensiveness and like all these defensive emotions. And I guess that was sort of naturally where it was heading. That's why I was interested in writing about the Reagan Revolution, because I thought it was the kind of propaganda, or it was kind of this version of like, well, just let businesses be business and governments really, you know, the seven scariest words, I'm from the government and I'm here to help you, you know, that all that rhetoric. It felt like, okay, well, you know, I get it. He's interested in, and that party's interested in fostering business and they don't want regulation. And so that means they kind of have to vilify the government a little bit, but it's okay. They're not out there putting violent, scary images into people's head. They're not demagoguing in a way that leads to terrorists and violence and synagogues being shot up or churches being shot up or schools being shot up or the IRS being shot up or the, you know, Arthur Murrah building being blown up in Oklahoma City. Like, we haven't gotten to the point where there's a lot of right-wing eliminationist rhetoric and terrorism. Well, now we're here.
You grew up in California, too. So Reagan was your governor before he became your president, right? And the state didn't devolve into flaming chaos during that period, despite the upheaval during his tenure.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that, like, it now seems quaint that Reagan went after the People's Park and tried to displace people, you know, and send in the National Guard. We now look at that and say, wow, compared to Trump, that guy was a cupcake. But the seeds of it were already there. The idea of this paranoid style and of getting people's primal negative emotions stirred up as a way of consolidating power on behalf of the wealthiest people in the country. And it's just this phony populism that's so dispiriting and gross and obviously just a friggin' Ponzi scheme. Having said that, that's not really where people live. People live in their own feelings and in their relationships, and if they feel despair and they feel, you know, grievance.
Or belittled.
That's right. There's already enough shame that's sort of there. I don't like when I look at a car that has a Trump bumper sticker. I don't like the bigot version of me that starts supposing who they are. They own a gun. They're male. They're white. They're racist. They hate immigrants. They hate brown people. They hate queer people. They hate trans people. I don't like that form of bigotry that lives in me, because I have no idea who that person is. I have no idea why they have that sticker. I have no idea what it means to them until I were to ask them. And they might say, I don't like everything he says, but I like that, I feel like he's standing up for me. Okay, well, I could try to point out to him or her or them, you know, a million ways in which that's fraudulent and he's just a con man. Can't you see it? But that's not going to undo their feelings. They have their own reason for making their decisions. And I can try to find fault with that, or I can just sit back and say, okay, we've got some work to do. If this is your hero, this shyster is your hero, we've got some work to do, like as a civic culture. The Fourth Estate has work to do. I think sort of the what I think of as the well-intentioned religious community in this country that does believe in the gospel of love as a revolutionary force and does believe in the Sermon on the Mount and, you know, what Christ was preaching, which is all about empathy and extending ourselves to the stranger and the immigrant and the iniquitous and those who are flawed and the people who are struggling with addiction and the communities that have been hollowed out by globalism. Where is the program to try to address that? And if it does exist, and I think, you know, folks on the left have been trying to address that, then how do we amplify those stories and say we actually do have a solution to, the ways in which communities really have suffered by, the onset of technology and automation and also a lot of jobs being sent overseas because workers in other parts of the world are willing to work cheaper. You know, the labor movement in this country it used to be robust, and there used to be a great sense of sort of unity and of a kind of old-fashioned collectivism that was viewed as very positive. You got to fight back against the CEOs. You got to, yes, there should be, it's not class warfare. It's just the redistribution of insane, immoral wealth. Like, you just get rid of one of your yachts, dude. Just get rid of one of your private planes since you have the money to buy 500 of them. I don't understand. I have no clue how it is that America has allowed these insane concentrations of wealth. You were talking about taxes earlier, Alex. You know, you have to kind of slow down and say to people, do you have any idea what the top marginal tax rate was under Eisenhower?
It's like 90%, right?
90% under Kennedy, 75%. And that's where I do trace a lot of this back to Reagan, where he basically said, I'm going to slash. We are just going to make America wonderful for the richest. And everybody else can just fight one another for whatever remains. And the fact that that story isn't being coherently told by the left and powerfully and amplified in the media allows these kind of phony populists, I think, to take advantage of people's very real pain.
Families buying dog food now. Starvation roams the street. Babies die before they're born, infected by the greed. Now some folks say that we should be glad for what we have. Tell me, would you be happy in a village ghetto land?
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to author Steve Almond. When you're talking about making a judgment on seeing a car with a Trump sticker, those people might have their own little community, their own little circle. And we've all gone into our own little bubbles of comfort, and the Venn diagrams don't overlap as much as they were overlapping in 1981 when your novel takes place. And I think that's one of the problems with our ability to educate each other and to empathize with each other, because it's so tribalistic.
The way I would say it is, rather than saying, is Trumpism a cult or not, it might be more useful to say, what do people get out of it? And to your point, part of what they get is a sense of inclusion and a sense of power because they have, you know, they're in ascendance, and they feel a kind of inside, deep inside, a sense of powerlessness. And so they plug into the strong man who will project a sense of power and not having to obey the rules and acting with impunity and not being held accountable. It's like omnipotence. It's really infantile and destructive, but it's also really seductive. And people plug into that. And once they're a part of that community and that belief system, the solutions become very simple, right? It's like, get rid of all the such and suches, whoever the scapegoat is. The evil doesn't exist inside of me. The evil exists out there, and we just have to go after it. People get something out of being a part of that movement, I think, especially the sort of the people who are the most passionate. And we can try to mock that, or we can say, yeah, we all want a sense of belonging. And it used to be that we had a more collective sense of, well, we're bonded, we're Americans, and that's something, we belong in that larger cohort. Now, I think by design, and the right has been very effective at doing this, they've essentially said, we define ourselves as being in opposition to the left. Remember Jefferson, compromise, compromise, compromise? Now it's fight, fight, fight. Maybe people on the left need to speak with more urgency and moral clarity, and they need to be willing to say, it is wrong and crazy and insane for billionaires to be the ones who are making the decisions in Washington. And nothing I'm saying is at all revolutionary. Teddy Roosevelt was saying it back in 1910, right? We need to break this cynical alliance between big government and big business. And now you got Elon Musk and his little band of his geek squad running around firing, you know, loyal federal workers. Everybody gets that you should try to eliminate fraud and waste. That's what the friggin' inspector generals are there for. Don't fire them. That's what they're doing. But if you see what I mean, there's this idea that has taken root that it's somehow okay for some billionaire donor who poured a bunch of money because of Citizens United into the Trump campaign to suddenly be in charge of the federal workforce with no experience, no... It seems to me, when I look at what they've done, that they've basically said what might actually help increase America's equity, capital, research capacity, humanity, empathy, Head Start, Social Security, all the stuff that actually makes America great and compassionate, and said, how can we get rid of that? And how can we then also make sure that the billionaires are the ones who decide how the government's money is spent? It's utterly insane. And what I think is that people on the left should be less frightened about saying how insane that arrangement is and how immoral and how much we should be up in arms. We should be furious about this, and we should take peaceful but firm action. We shouldn't just say, oh, well, what can I do about it? Gee, you know, let me post something on Facebook, or let me lament what Rachel Maddow has to say on MSNBC. Like, enough. There should be a greater sense of urgency. I think that's why people like Bernie Sanders and AOC are resonating, because they're speaking that language of moral clarity. It's not radicalism. Moral clarity is not radicalism. Or if it is, it's good radicalism.
Stay tuned next week for the second half of our conversation with author Steve Almond.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Gonzalez, Gil Scott-Heron, and Stevie Wonder.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.